Aloha, I'm Bill Dorman in today for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation. They're arguing about health care in Washington today, but what does that mean for Hawaii? Actually, quite a bit. We'll talk about that with Governor Josh Green, along with a number of other issues. And why are detained immigrants being flown from the continental United States to Hawaii? It's been going on since this summer. We'll have a live report on a special HPR News investigation. Plus, we hear about a new Filipino web series that tells a love story rooted in plantation-era Maui. And we meet a jazz singer from a storied musical family. She'll be performing in Honolulu this weekend. Aloha, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman in for Catherine Cruz today. As you've heard this morning on NPR, Congress is approaching its year-end recess, and members are still struggling over health care coverage for millions of Americans. It's a debate that has a deep impact here in Hawaii. If subsidies under the Affordable Care Act expire at the end of the year as expected, that will leave tens of thousands of Hawaii residents with dramatically higher insurance costs and will also affect rural health care across the state. Governor Josh Green has a plan. It involves using $16.5 million in state money to plug that gap and continue those subsidies in the short term. We talked about it earlier this morning. Aloha, Governor. Mahalo for joining us. As we talk this morning, health insurance coverage is under discussion in Congress, but the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act are likely to expire 2 weeks from today. This week, you wrote that if that happens, it's going to hit the coverage of some 20,000 residents of Hawaii, driving costs higher immediately and leaving about 8,000 in our community without any coverage. You're putting $16.5 million in the state budget to cover that gap. Two questions. How long will that hold the line for those lost federal payments, and how confident are you that the legislature is going to go along with the plan?
Well, thank you for asking. Right. We put that line item budget of $16.5 million in to basically cover or replace what the enhanced subsidies would have been should they act in Congress and cover the Affordable Care Act needs. I think the legislature will likely support this. You know, supporting the Affordable Care Act is not just about supporting the people that are in the plan. It's also about making sure that our rural hospitals don't suddenly, you know, lose a lot of resource, that they don't have extra pressure across the system and close. That's what's going to happen nationally. Our 24,000 individuals that are somehow affected one way or another by changes to the Affordable Care Act are actually 4 million people on the mainland, just to give you an idea. And states all across the country really should follow our lead if they can and do this. So I think the ledge will go along with it. We have the resources. It's a tight year because what happened at the federal level was all the tariffs and the shutdown and the many things that have happened by decreasing our funding has basically cost us $3 billion. But we had saved, and I had line item vetoed in the past $1 billion, so we're okay. But I think we have to do it.
You know, the healthcare debate does come at a time of what feels like economic fragility in the country at large. What's your sense of where Hawaii's economy is right now?
Hawaii's economy is strong enough to survive. It is affected by the national decisions that are being made. When there's less tourism, we have less revenue. We are seeing an increase in travel again from Japan, which is very helpful. That's always been one major part of our, you know, tourism economy. But it could go either way. And we have not yet had a clear demonstrated set of data that would suggest a recession. That requires two consecutive quarters of negative growth. But things have been softer. And that's why I said earlier that what the Feds have done is they've hurt, you know, the nation's economy to some degree. And it's $3 billion for us. We, like I said, can, you know, go out over several years. We can navigate it. I have rainy day funds of $1.6 billion to use if absolutely necessary. But what we need is more stability. We need them to, you know, move away from the things that have been hurting travel and other industries like building. You know, we're doing a lot of construction now, but when it's more expensive to get materials to rebuild Maui, to build housing on Oahu and the rest of the neighbor islands, everything is harder for us. So I have us teed up to have a lot of different economies to work through, but it makes it tighter and harder in general to do many things that we dream of.
You mentioned those challenges and the costs and the uncertainties really surrounding the whole situation. It's been about a year and a half now since you signed the biggest state income tax cut in Hawaii's history into law. Are you going to have to roll some of that back?
Yeah, the word is pause in this case. So not roll back technically. So we signed a tax plan, which was about a $5.5 billion tax break for our state. Because of the $3 billion that came out of our economy, the third year is going to come to a close, you know, after 2026. And then we had three other years, you know, in place for the tax break, 27, 28, and 29. Those years, we will pause any further, you know, deep cuts. So we've already locked in over $4 billion of the tax break. What we will do is we will bring $1.8 billion back into our, you know, our economy, back into the state, so we don't have to cut any jobs, we don't have to cut any programs. And then I will kind of inject $600 million in tax breaks or tax support to those who are most vulnerable so that we have like extra food tax credits. So essentially, I'm going to pull back $1.2 billion of that $5.5 billion initial tax package. So the people that will not get as much tax break in 27, 28, and 29 will be more affluent people. And I think everyone will understand because, first off, some of the reason we have less money nationally and in the states is because they locked in tax breaks for the very wealthy and for corporations. So some people were already now getting that. But people who are, you know, families of four up to, say, $100,000, they're going to get all of the tax breaks and even actually some more because they're the ones that are having, you know, trouble finding money to buy groceries or to pay their rent. That's the adjustment that we're proposing to the legislature. The leadership already seems very intent on, you know, working with us on this. I think everyone's pretty much on the same page. So again, I'll say it simply. We passed a six-year plan that would have brought $5.5 billion of tax break to people. It's going to end up being closer to $4 billion, but we're going to maintain all of the tax breaks for people who are, you know, working families, basically.
We're going to continue our talk this morning with Governor Josh Green, including some thoughts on the legislature when we come back. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to helping women get healthy at their women's 10K and 5K fun run next January. Details and registration at hphwomens10k.org.
All of us at Hawaii Public Radio are so grateful for the many individuals, families, local businesses, community partners, and foundations that demonstrate so many ways to be generous. Mahalo. Your support enables trusted local news and music that is 100% independent. Support from first-time givers will keep HPR strong and moving forward together. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, featuring the films of Andrei Tarkovsky through December 27th, including Solaris and Mirror. Schedule and tickets at honolulumuseum.org.
Welcome back to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, in today for Catherine Cruz. We're continuing our talk this morning with Governor Josh Green. Governor, you talked about a lot of the uncertainty coming because of what's going on in Washington. Where else do you see gaps emerging for Hawaii because of federal action or inaction that's going to directly affect the people of Hawaii and areas where state money may have to fill those gaps?
Well, there's a couple areas that come to mind. One of them is research grants at the university. There have been cuts there and at the Cancer Center and at JABSM. And a lot of that work was just so necessary for us. So losing grants like that is difficult. I'm reaching out to philanthropy to see what I can do to bring in some extra resources, but that's a problem. And it's a problem that's probably going to persist all the way through 2028. The other concerns I have, for example, are the approach to immigration. Now, I want everyone to know we are on the same page as the current administration. If there's a criminal, if someone's committed terrible crimes, then they should not, you know, be allowed to stay in Hawaii or any, you know, any state if they're not a legal immigrant and they're, you know, breaking our laws. However, we have a lot of people that have been immigrants and they haven't yet qualified for permanent citizenship. Maybe they haven't done it right and processed, you know, all their applications, but they're working in good standing. They're working in agriculture. Maybe they're working in tourism. Many of them are Filipino citizens and they've been here for decades. And I really think that we have to have some kind of closure on this. I think that the president and the others in Congress need to finally pass legislation to care for people and give them citizenship if they've been in good standing and are contributing to society. That's what happened with, you know, our grandparents and great grandparents. So that's a problem for us. We could see a lot of economic downturn and downside if suddenly, you know, our agriculture and tourism workforce were forced to leave. So that's a big deal. You know, I'm going to make sure that we also bring extra resources in if, and I say this very bluntly, if the federal government does choose to condemn lands for military purposes, for national security, if they go that route, we've talked about this, it's now put off a year, but if they go that route, I'm going to insist, and I think most citizens would expect me to insist, that there is a major package of community benefits for our state to help us with our energy needs, to help us with our housing needs. Because if we're going to be in Ohana with the military and there's, you know, more than 100,000 people living in the islands, we really have to have, you know, a collegial amount of support. And so I have asked for a $10 billion consideration. That would help us a lot, too. So there's always a lot going on. In the immediate, I'm going to navigate our, you know, our large tax cut package and make it sane and helpful to those who need it most. And I will do it with the legislature. And then also I'm going to protect kind of, you know, the doctor in me protects the heart and the central nervous system, which is all of our workers. There might be some things on the fringe, want-to-haves that we can't have in these next couple years, but we'll keep addressing housing. We'll keep addressing homelessness. We'll keep addressing food insecurity, and we'll keep making sure our schools are okay. We can weather those storms.
You know, you mentioned military leases of land in Hawaii, and this week, as you know, Congress passed the Defense Authorization Bill. Several members of the congressional delegation here in Hawaii have pointed out that does not include any additional authority to condemn state land in order to seize it. What impact might that have on your discussions on the leases, and what's the latest on where those talks are?
Right. That's the exact question to ask. So that was good news. That was what we wanted, which was them not to do the NDAA, that's the National Defense Authorization Act. We did not want that language passed where they could move towards taking our lands this year. This gives us time to discuss it further. I have an excellent committee, an advisory committee, to give me updates. I think the updates will be quarterly directly to me, and they'll be meeting monthly with the community to make sure that we're all on the same page. And that is helpful. Also, it's been pointed out very clearly to me by some of our own military leaders that we should be getting more investment anyway. Before this discussion is finalized about military lands, there's a lot more that should be done from the federal government for our state because of our, you know, our presence in the Pacific. The Indo-Pacific makes up 60% of our military operations globally. And so Hawaii, which is at the epicenter of that, needs more support because we do things like have our hospitals available to everybody. We rent houses out to everyone that comes through in service with the military. We do so many things. And this is being kind of rediscussed because, you know, a lot of those leases were like for a dollar, which that was just done as a, you know, kind of a contractual and a terrible idea, contractual obligation. And we, of course, get investment from the military, but it's time that we rethink this. And I think just come to common ground. I think that it's pretty clear that most people feel that the military is here for the good of the country and for national security. And most people also feel it has a very serious impact. So because they will have to wait until next December to pass the next NDAA, we have a lot of time now for me to continue to go to Washington when needed, to send my cabinet there, to get input from our advisory council on what should actually be done. You know, I asked, for example, for over $1 billion of extra resources to help us finish off our rail and do housing along the rail. I asked for over $1 billion directly for housing. I asked for monies to support our energy transition so that we could have cleaner and cheaper energy overall rather than taking in fossil fuels from Libya, which is where we get our diesel. So a lot of big projects are in that discussion, and also the cleanup projects. We would like Makua Valley to come fully back to Hawaii, and we would like local companies to be able to clean up the munitions. These were things that I have been and will continue to discuss with all the leadership in the country, but I welcome the help from other, you know, top stakeholders, and frankly, any citizen that wants to give us ideas. We often take great ideas directly from people. When I'm out walking around, people tap me on the shoulder and say, have you thought of this? Or they call me on my cell phone, or they pick the brain of my communications director or my chief of staff. That's how we operate. So we have this year to take in input, and it will be my job to, you know, be strong and to insist that we're treated fairly.
Governor, thanks so much for your time today. And in spite of all the challenges, happy holidays.
Thank you. You too. My best to your whole clan.
Thank you. Likewise. We'll be back shortly. You're listening to the conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. For about 6 months, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has been sending immigrants to the Federal Detention Center in Honolulu. While the numbers are not official, attorneys at the Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic at the UH William S. Richardson School of Law put it in the dozens. HPR's Ashley Mizuo has been working on this story, along with the conversation's executive producer, Maddie Bender. Ashley joins us this morning to talk about that. Ashley, thanks for coming on. And what's the starting point for this whole story?
Yeah, so what we're looking at is Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, you know, has been transferring people who they detained on the continental United States and then transfer them to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. And this is going on as early as this summer. Maddie and I spoke with ACLU Hawaii Immigration Rights Attorney Leilani Stacy, who's been working, you know, with immigration attorneys and people on the ground to try to understand what's going on.
The hard part is, there's not public access to information about how many detainees are at FDC in any given moment, let alone how many of those are being transferred from the continent. It's not exactly clear to us or to anyone really as to the rhyme or reason why someone from California or Florida would be transferred here, particularly when they have no connection here.
So kind of to give an example of like what this looks like in practice, we spoke with Narabelle Chardone, a senior staff attorney with the Hawaii nonprofit, The Legal Clinic, and she recently represented a 23-year-old client, and he was bounced between Florida, Louisiana, California, and Hawaii all within a month.
And more than one stop at each place.
Yes, so that's why I say it bounced too, because it's not even a linear, like each place, kind of like back and forth to other places, and ended up though in the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. And you know, his mom had a hard time reaching him, and he lost his legal representation when he was transferred to the Honolulu FDC because the legal support funds were that he was originally using in California are only for California residents. So when he left the state because he was transferred out, he couldn't have that legal representation anymore. And so that's one of the issues that, you know, Leilani Stacy is looking at, the separation from resources and support, you know, Hawaii's geographic isolation and Hawaii's also lack of Spanish-speaking attorneys are some of her main concerns.
In some ways, the transfer here to FDC Honolulu is just part of that larger game that's being played. And I shouldn't call it a game. These are people's lives. When you send people across an ocean who might not speak English as their first language, who know no one on the ground, no family to come visit them and tell them, oh, these are the local attorneys or anything like that. It's a really big concern.
And so, you know, Maddie spoke with Joaquin Rico, who this exact situation happened to. Rico is Venezuelan, and he entered the U.S. Unlawfully 3.5 years ago and has been living in California. You know, when he was there, he was working in construction. He owned a car. He was sending money back to his sick father. And then in July, ICE officers detained him and brought him to San Francisco. And then 3 days later, he was transferred to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. You know, he has never been in prison before, but was placed with the general population of incarcerated people among those who are awaiting charges for federal crimes, including murder. Rico says that no one told him why he was being transferred to Hawaii. And to him, he says, you know, the only thing that makes sense is that it was kind of a tactic to tire him out and make him want to self-deport. He was there for about 3 months, and he estimated that there were maybe about 10 or 15 people like him that were separated from California and had been moved to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. And when he was released from the Honolulu Federal Detention Center, you know, his phone was dead. He doesn't speak very well good English, and so, you know, Spanish is his primary language, so he doesn't speak the language, and was trying to get back to California. And, you know, he called it an odyssey when he was talking with Maddie. The Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic at the University of Hawaii at Manoa Law School estimates that there's between, you know, 40 and 80 immigrants being currently detained at the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. And that doesn't even include the people who are necessarily being transferred. There's not exact numbers because there's no real-time numbers coming out of Honolulu FDC.
And there's no communication. You mentioned this in terms of reaching out to ICE. You did hear Bureau of Prisons, but the idea of we have no obligation to tell you how many people are in different situations, and that sort of makes it tricky. And at the same time, because this is a federal issue, the jurisdiction is in the hands of the feds. So according to what, they don't have to.
Exactly. And I think that that's some of the issues, you know, questions like how many people are in the Honolulu Federal Detention Center? How many people have been transferred? Are you holding the people who are being detained for immigration reasons being held with the general population of the Federal Detention Center? Right. Those are all things that, you know, I asked the Bureau of Prisons, who came back and said that, you know, any questions related to immigration, even these regarding the Honolulu Federal Detention Center, need to be sent to ICE, and then ICE did not respond.
At all.
And so it's just really hard to get information, you know, out from there. And like you said, when we're looking at the types of jurisdiction, like the state has really no way of doing anything because it is under, you know, the federal jurisdiction.
It's a federal facility.
Exactly.
That it just is on in Hawaii,
yes.
But it's under federal control.
Yeah, and I think part of the issue there too is that, you know, when you're in immigration court, you do have a right to legal representation, but there's no equivalent to like a public defender. Like, they don't assign you a lawyer. And so that's another issue here, is that there are really limited options for people when it comes to finding legal representation. You know, in Hawaii, there are only about 12 nonprofit immigration attorneys in the state. Only 6 of those actually represent clients regularly. And, you know, private attorneys can be really expensive, like $10,000 for an asylum case. And then out of those nonprofit lawyers, only about 3 of them speak Spanish, and then one of them being Chardon. And to put in perspective, you know, 90% of the center's immigration clients are Hispanic. And I asked if she's ever experienced this level of immigration in Hawaii before.
Never, ever. At least here in Hawaii, never. Number one, the immigration detainees in Hawaii were extremely low. From 2019 to 2023, when I was in private practice, I only represented 2 people in detention. Now the Federal Detention Center is my second home. Sometimes I go there and see 6 people, 4 people. One day I went and I saw 8 people.
And so when you're looking at, you know, just kind of the rise in immigration enforcement in Hawaii, just generally, you know, those numbers have jumped over 200% in the last year. In all of 24, there were only about 45 arrests locally. And then in 2025, between January and July this year, which is the latest data we have, that's jumped to 150 in about half the amount of time.
You know, part of your story that really strikes at the core of a lot of things is people sometimes think of immigration as not an issue in this sense, is not an issue that touches Hawaii, but it does very directly, and it has been going on, and it's continuing.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that when you look at how this is happening locally, we're talking about just arrests in Hawaii specifically, but then now you add on this layer of people being transferred from the continental U.S. Who have been detained there and then being transferred to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. It's not exactly clear why that's happening. You know, one of the reasons that has been given is because they need capacity, they need more space, and, you know, the Federal Detention Center in Honolulu has space. Underused, you know. It's barely filling a quarter of its capacity in the general population there. And so that's why it became one of eight facilities in the country that's managed by the Federal Bureau of Prisons that accepts those detained by ICE.
Congressional delegation is aware and looking at this, yes?
Yes, exactly. You know, Congresswoman Jill Tokuda says she's planning her visit to the facility and is going to check on the status of whether the facility has started separating those who are detained by ICE from the general population.
Interesting. And previous plans for that were interrupted because of the government shutdown.
Exactly.
Interesting. Great story. HBR's Ashley Mizzou reporting with HBR's Maddie Bender on immigrants being sent from the continental United States to the Federal Detention Center in Honolulu. You can hear an extended version of this report this afternoon on All Things Considered and find it online later today at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we're going on a nature walk, and with any luck, you might see a special plant. This can be found in the dry lowlands of Oahu and Molokai, and it lives in scattered patches or a dense interwoven mat. If you catch sight of this tiny marvel at the right time of year, the fronds will float on the pond surface like a lily pad. This plant is called Ihi'ihi Laaokea. It shares a name with the Wind of Hanauma and a crater on Oahu's eastern side. The plant bears a striking resemblance to a four-leaf clover, but it's actually not a clover at all. Today we want to know, what group of plants does Ihi'ihi belong to? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets an HBR reusable tote bag. We'll also throw in a deck of the card game Kumulaau from our friends at Trees for Honolulu's future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NereidHawaii.com.
Filipino plantation worker in 1940s Hawaii and his grandson in the Ilocos region of the Philippines are two of the subjects of a web series that debuted at NewFest, New York's LGBTQ+ film festival. It was also recently in a film festival in Africa, and it's headed to Asia this weekend. It's called All the Things I Leave You, and it's filmed in Ilocos, where the story begins. HPR's Catherine Cruz talked to Maui attorney Lance Collins, who's the creator and showrunner of the web series. He explains how it all came to be.
15 years ago, my grandmother died, my Filipino grandmother, and my grandfather gave me, it was just a cardboard box, but it was filled with letters that they had written to each other one summer when they were apart, when they were in their early 20s. And I opened up one and I read it and, you know, very innocent. It's like, oh, I miss you. Please stay true. You know, that kind of thing. And then I decided, what did I decide? I decided that I wasn't going to read any of them until my grandfather passed away. I was like, okay, well, this is not too, doesn't seem too private, but at the same time, like, I'll wait. But I did have my nephew scan all of them because I was like, well, you know, maybe fire or bugs or something. So anyways, I didn't think about the letters again. But what it did come into my mind was, okay, what about all of the stories of folks back in the 40s and the 50s who potentially exchanged these types of letters, but there aren't grandchildren to receive them, or they weren't, nobody thought to save them, that sort of thing, like the sort of ephemeral history. And so one thing led to another, and then I came up with this story about, it's a sort of a modern day love story, but it's intertwined with this love story that didn't happen, didn't end on good terms back in the 1940s, with people sort of not allowing these love letters to go back and forth and so sort of the love story to carry on. So that it, that was 15 years ago. And then we tried to get a director. We tried to get funding. I got Lilia Santiago, who's passed away, but she was a professor in the Ilocano Language and Literature Program, which I also taught in. And she had actually said, you know, it's actually very, she was very affected by the story because when she was growing up in Baguio, her uncle apparently had been writing to some woman that he was in love with. And somehow somebody in the family took the letter that was delivered and opened it up and read it. And his love story was uncovered. And, you know, I guess the family, I wouldn't say persecuted him, but she's basically said that they, that it was not good. And she thought that that was, she felt that it was very bad. So anyways, long story short is, we tried to find directors. We tried to find funding. We found a director. We didn't have funding. We found funding. The director wasn't interested in anymore. And it was just back and forth. And then eventually Lilia retired and she moved away. And so I thought, okay, well, I guess it's me. And then at around the time that the pandemic happened, I just sort of decided like, well, I think this project isn't going to move forward because like it's taken forever and it's not gone anywhere. So then I ended up doing my partner with Kaylee E. Grace. And that's the Hawaii boys love story that takes place completely in Lahaina. And that was supposed to be in Ilocano. But the problem was when we did the casting call for the Ilocano actors, we got like no responses at all. In hindsight, I think the reason why is that people didn't really know what we were asking for. And because it had the BL term, I think possibly young male actors were thinking like, oh, this is going to be soft porn or something, which it wasn't in any way. We got a PG rating. But Kaylee really put a lot of pressure and we changed to Tagalog, which it isn't Tagalog, right? The Filipino dialogue isn't Tagalog. And I decided that if I agreed to that, which I did, that I would commit to doing this previous story in Ilocano so that there would be an Ilocano film or web series or something of similar length and duration, because I felt a bit guilty that my partner wasn't done in Ilocano.
And then tell us, so this did then get produced and you've rolled it out at a number of film festivals and it's doing well.
Yeah, we premiered at New Fest, which is big film festival in New York on October 13th. And we've just had a screening in Africa at the African International Human Rights Film Festival that was in Nigeria this year. And next week, we're going to be showing in China. And I think we're going to India early next year. And we have a couple of other film festivals coming up. And our hope is, and that the plan is that this will be available to the general public by early summer of next year. And I mean, I'm just like, let's just put it up on YouTube, but I guess it's a little more when you have all these different groups that have a stake in it, it's not quite so straightforward. So our intention is that this should be up early summer or the end of spring possibly.
Yeah, so tell us about the story and why you think that it may be resonating.
The story starts where we meet one of the main characters. His name is George, and he's kind of like a little spoiled rich kid who works for his grandfather's restaurant in San Nicolas, Ilocos Norte. And he encounters this guy who the grandfather ends up immediately hiring as the delivery boy. They needed a delivery boy and a social media manager, and so they hired this. But there's a conflict because on the way to the restaurant, the potential delivery boy basically splashes mud on George. So the other boy is Kiko. And anyway, so they're sort of in this like enemy situation. And then something happens to the grandfather and he ends up in the hospital, and they end up quickly bonding because Kiko's got the motorcycle and can help George basically get around to get the things the grandfather needs. And, the grandfather passes away. And in that process, the two of them end up getting closer by bonding, and then they discover a old cigar box full of unopened letters that were from the grandfather addressed to this person that nobody knows. And then they also find pictures. And the magical part of the story is that the young version of the grandfather is played by the same character as the present day George. And that's one of the themes, like, oh, you're a spitting image of your grandfather kind of thing. And in these pictures in the cigar box, we find the person looks identical to the delivery boy is the other guy in these seemingly very close friendship or something pictures of these two young men that basically in their present day, it's like, oh, look, it's us, but it's in the 1940s. And then they eventually discover that the other person that's being written to is Kiko, the delivery boy's grandfather. And so there's this story about, they're trying to get out of, their poverty, and they apply to go to Hawaii, and only Tino, the grandfather, gets, George's grandfather, gets accepted. I don't want to give the whole story, story away, but yeah, that's basically where their trajectory goes off into a different direction. And some of the things that you learn is, in Ilocos now and previously, people think of Hawaii as this, milk and honey, roads painted in gold, what are known as the Casa Gloria stories. And what we find in this series is actually the reality, or, the audience is educated on what the reality is. It's exploitative conditions. There were racial hierarchies, racial animus, gendered forms of oppression, that the Big Five had a very specific purpose, which is they wanted people who would work and could be controlled. And they used many means to do that. And so part of the story is basically informing everybody who may not be familiar with that in a way that doesn't seem heavy-handed or just lecturing people about the past, but that, there are material consequences to that. And one of them is these two young men who, had cared for each other and, had some form of an intimate relationship. Basically, that the pressures for them to do what they needed to do in their traditional society sort of interfaced with what the Big Five was doing to control labor. And they ended up having an unfinished love story back in the 1940s.
It's interesting, just to hear that the nuance of, the political times and the social culture and what's accepted and not accepted, and the fact that you've been able to blend that story together.
Well, we had a private screening for cast and crew in Ilocos. And so several people invited their grandparents, which I was always very little nervous, especially with like my partner when we had the community screenings out in Hana and Molokai. I was like, oh my gosh, there's going to be a problem here. But actually it's like the older folks are the ones that seem to enjoy these movies the most because they see themselves represented in different ways, not necessarily in the, boys love angle of the story, but see their life represented on screen in a way that there's very few representations of Hawaii life or Ilocano life for that matter. But some of these seniors who came to watch the movie, there actually are words in Ilocano to describe the two young men, that relationship that people who are like under 50 had never heard these words before. And so that was a very interesting after the screening when people were just talking that there are terms like ag darling is one of them, and like younger people had no idea, and it was a little bit of a surprise. It's like, oh wait, there's words for this in Ilocano. So yeah, so that was the process of the audience basically watching it, and that part of it's also very fascinating, and I look forward to hearing more about those kinds of things.
But at the end of the day, it was a story that rings true. It was authentic, and like you said, it revealed a side of life that older generation was familiar with and knew existed, but maybe kept under wraps.
Right. And I think even in a more universal sense, a lot of if you listen to the oral histories of Chinese, not so much Japanese, although there are Japanese stories of this, but, you know, a lot of people's lives and who they wanted to be with or all of that was greatly shaped by the labor management practices of the Big Five. And I think people don't really think too much about, people don't think about history much. At all, ever. But when they do, I don't think people really think about, like, well, you know, how is it that I'm, like, Hawaiian Chinese? Like, what, for a lot of people, what does that mean? And I know a lot of folks who are, like, Hawaiian Filipino who, for different reasons, don't really know anything about their Filipino side. And other than the Japanese who had the pitcher bride system, there were these huge imbalances of bachelor societies of Chinese and bachelor societies of Filipinos. And so the choices for, like, Filipino men were you either marry whoever in Hawaii might be interested, or you go back to Ilocos, or you are a bachelor, or you go to California. And so, you know, that has a significant impact in terms of, like, how communities, you know, enter into the present is through all of that. And I think this story, even though the two main characters are young men, I think that story about how economic forces shape how people are able to live their lives and the limitations that are imposed that we have no control over or very little control over. I think that's a universal phenomenon, and I think it's something that many people in Hawaii that come from the plantation time are impacted by. So I think it's a universal story in that sense.
Lance Collins and HBR's Catherine Cruz discussing the film All the Things I Leave You. The web series will be showing at the Tianjin International Academic Film Festival this weekend.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy, assisting local businesses in reducing energy waste. Learn more about lighting upgrades available through February at hawaiienergy.com/lighting.
I'm Anita Rao, embodied as WUNC's weekly radio show and podcast about sex, relationships, and health. Join me to meet people who aren't afraid to question what we think we know about intimacy, who are embracing the unique ways their bodies shape their lived experience, and who have some fascinating stories to share about their relationships. We'll take on the taboo together, next time on Embodied.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for HPR comes from the law firm of Damon Key Leong Kupchak Hastert, committed to providing legal solutions for Hawaii's business community since 1963, extending best wishes for a safe holiday season. HawaiiLawyer.com.
Now it's time to test your luck and reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier in the show, we introduced you to a Hawaiian water clover. The tiny fronds are shaped like a shamrock or a four-leaf clover, and these plants are found in dry lowlands, though they do need water to reproduce. The Ihiihi Laokea is listed as endangered due to effects of climate change and invasive herbivores. If you're lucky enough to see one, you might think you hit the jackpot and found a four-leaf clover. Alas, that is not the case. These lookalikes are actually ferns, a rare endemic fern that has disappeared from historical sites such as Kaimuki and Honolulu due to urban development. The species name, Villosa, means hairy and refers to the fine white leaves covering the plant. Found in dry lowlands, these plants depend on the wet season for survival. Hikers around Cocoa Head and elsewhere may still see the ferns while hiking a crater west of Hanauma Bay. The name means wide-leafed ihi-ihi. That is today's quiz. And we had a lot of calls on this one, actually. But first through the gate was Eric from Honolulu, who saw the plant on a hike just this weekend. How about that? That's today's quiz. If you have a backyard quiz to share, write us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Off with my glove. I need no overcoat.
If the voice sounds familiar, for decades, jazz singer Antonia Bennett performed with her father, musician Tony Bennett, who you just heard, as he toured around the world. She remembers singing the Hokey Pokey and Santa Claus is Coming to Town on stage with Tony when she was just a kid. Antonia started a solo career after her father passed away from Alzheimer's disease in 2023. Her most recent album, Expressions, has been praised as subtle, sincere, and deeply personal. Bennett spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender before two nights of jazz planned for this weekend at Lures Lounge.
Did you always know that you would be a professional jazz performer? Do you think it was like a nature or a nurture thing?
Probably a little bit of both. I think, you know, there were a lot of things that I liked to do. I liked acting when I was a kid. I really liked dancing. And I just kind of always did the singing. I actually probably in the early years had the least training in music. I would say my formal training didn't really start until I was at music school at Berklee College of Music in Boston, which was college already. So before that, I really just, you know, I got up on stage and sang a few songs with my dad, and I always liked to do that. And I memorized a lot of songs because I watched all these musicals and I loved. So I knew a lot of standards, and it just kind of happened through osmosis. And then I wanted to learn more. So I went to music school, and it was really there that I kind of saw what I could do and really started to dive into the songs and do it on a deeper level.
Taking a look at your most recent album, Expressions, I mean, there's Brazilian jazz influence, there's French, you have an original song in Baby, but talk about how all of those influences come together to create you.
So I think, you know, after a certain amount of time, everything starts to kind of unfold naturally. And I was in no rush to make that record. And I was on the road with my dad. When I first started working on that record, you know, it was before COVID. And then I did the first batch of tunes, and then I just got so busy that I couldn't get around to doing the next batch of tunes and get all the same guys together on the date, because it's about trying to get everybody's schedules to match up too. And then COVID happened, and then I got sick with long COVID, and then it was a long time before I got my voice back, and then we went in and did another group of songs. And then I just kind of waited again. I didn't know. I mean, I had enough songs at that point to be done. But then I just, you know, I didn't really finish everything, like all the little details. And then I went in a third time. I was like, you know what? I know I have enough songs, but somehow I just don't know if the sequence of all these songs together are going to work. I want to go in and round it off. So then I rounded it off with another four tunes. I pulled a couple tunes out off of the record. I was like, I'm going to save these for not something else. And so it all just came together, and I was able to add some of my original tunes. And I sang a song of one of my roommates in college, Chiara Civello, Wherever You Go. And I just kind of put it all together because each thing was like a little kind of snapshot of my life at a certain time, and it worked.
Around that time, and before and after, your family was dealing with Tony's diagnosis of Alzheimer's. What are some of the things you took away from that experience? And do you feel like seeing him perform into his later years showed you some power of music that you maybe hadn't fully realized before.
I mean, I think the whole thing about losing a parent is something that you just, you know that it's going to happen because none of us are getting out of here alive, but you don't really, until it happens to you, it's always shocking. I mean, he was 2 weeks short of 97, which is a good long life, but it's still, it's very shocking and devastating. And at the same time, I know that we were so lucky to have him for so long. And yes, watching him sing into his later years, it made me really happy because I knew that he was doing something that he liked and that it was keeping him young. And he used to say, well, when you retire, that's when you die. Because he really loved what he did. And my dad's mother was a seamstress. And he always tells me, he always would tell me that she would make dresses for a penny a day. And all he ever wanted to do is make enough money so that she could retire. And he was at some point able to do that. But when she did retire, she got very sick. And she was old at that point, and she had worked so hard her whole life. And so my dad used to always say, well, when you retire, that's when you die. And I think he really believed that because he was so fortunate to do something that he loved and that really kept him going for so long. And he was really blessed in that way.
Is there anything at all about the relationship you have now with your daughter? I mean, you're a mother and also a performer that you see in the relationship that you had with your dad.
Well, I see in both her mother and her father. I mean, her dad is likes to cook. He's a great chef. And so she always says, when I grow up, I want to be a singer and a chef. So, she's still at that age where she just wants to do what we're doing. And it's sweet.
So you'll be in Hawaii later this week. Can I ask, what's your opinion on Christmas music? Love it, hate it?
I love it. I mean, I've recorded a whole holiday record and, you know, those songs, you hear them every year, and a lot of them are such classics, beautifully done, and there's something a little melancholy because you're remembering, like, past time or people that are no longer here with you, but then also creating new memories, and it's so such a beautiful thing. I'm just super happy to be coming back to Hawaii. The last time I was there was actually with my dad, so this is my first time there performing without him, and I'm really just thrilled to kind of be going and working with wonderful musicians and staying in a beautiful place. So I really can't complain. I can't think of a better. I could be going, usually around this time of year, I'm on my way somewhere really cold. So this is quite nice. I just hope people will want to come out and hear me play and enjoy the holiday spirit at the Hale Kulani.
Jazz singer Antonio Bennett and HBR's Maddie Bender. Bennett takes a stage at Luer's Lounge Friday and Saturday nights. Jazz and holiday songs. More information on our website later today. That's the program for today. Up tomorrow, we check in on flu season this year. Hospitals seeing a spike in emergency room visits. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.